Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to episode 221 with Robin Gelfenbein. But first, a bit about our sponsor. This episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. You can get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. My guest this week, Robin Gelfenbein, makes her own homemade ice cream cakes to share with the audience of her storytelling show, Yum's the Word. This show brings together my two very favorite things, comedy and ice cream. So let's see what Audible knows about ice cream. Oh, it's a lot of fun fiction and one book on Ben and Jerry. Awesome. Man, I need to add ice cream to my grocery list. Audible is available for your iPhone, Android, or Kindle. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. This week on Yes But Why, I talk to New York City-based storyteller, writer, and comedian Robin Gelfenbein. Robin is the creator and host of the storytelling series and podcast Yum's the Word that features amazing stories alongside her homemade ice cream cakes. In our conversation, Robin tells us the stories of her life that have helped beget award-winning theater. She talks about taking classes in sketch comedy and storytelling, and later teaching those classes and inspiring future performers. Support this hard-working woman of comedy by taking one of her storytelling classes. And you should listen to Robin's podcast, Yum's the Word. Robin and I are actually both going to be speaking at the PodFest Global Summit. Check that out to support both of us by going to podfestexpo.com and signing up for your free tickets to the event. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 221. Robin Gelfenbein is the ambassador of fun. Enjoy! I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I just felt like I always knew. Oh, yeah. Because I was always being a clown in the house. I mean, I was very quiet outside of the house, but in my house, like, any family members knew, because I was always mugging for the camera and being silly. I was always making up characters, putting on different, like, we'd go to my grandmother's and I would put on grandparents' like coats or hats or grab an umbrella, and I would just make characters up. I would sit at my grandmother's table and flip a bowl over and say to my whole family, "I want to tell you your fortunes." And then I would just make stuff up. And so, like, I just was always making things up. And I did like children's theater as a kid, and I never wanted, I mean, in some ways I wanted to play the lead, but I was always more drawn to, like, the witch or like the sidekick, you know, because they were funny. They were the ones who got the laughs.
Yeah.
So I feel like I just started when I was really young. Awesome. And I just thought it was super fun, you know?
Yeah.
And then I just was making stuff. I would make up dance routines, and I would make up roller skating routines in the basement. Like, my poor sisters, I was always like making them do things and like directing us in our little dance routine shows and stuff. And like, everything was meant to be, you know, it was fun choreography, but it was also meant to be really silly, you know. They're not necessarily funny.
How many sisters do you have?
I have two younger sisters, and there's 5-year difference between the youngest and me.
Oh, okay. So you were really like, all right, listen.
I had a lot of control.
I'm in charge. I'm the lead.
Yeah, I was like, let's do this.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, man, I have one sibling, and I have all these memories of, like, being alone doing shows by myself in the basement. So I'm like, what happened to my sister? Where is she? Like, where is she in my memories? Maybe she was sitting there, and I was just so involved with my own self. Who knows? your parents, they noticed that you were quite the performer, so they got you into plays and shows when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a lot in the way of classes around here. I grew up in the Hartford area, but there were opportunities to do children's theater. But I did that in high school, and I did it in the neighboring town, and my mom did theater when we were growing up, so she was... It's funny to think about the songs that she was singing, because it didn't register for me, and now I'm like, oh, yeah. She auditioned with the song Can't Say No from Oklahoma. Do you know mm-hmm. that song?
Yep, I do know that song. Yep. She auditioned for a play singing that?
Yeah, some musicals. So she was always rehearsing in the living room. That's where we have a piano. And she's a good voice, but it's just funny to me now, because if you think about those lyrics, it's like, yikes, you can't say no.
Yeah, there's a lot problematic about old musicals. I definitely did Oklahoma in 10th grade, so I understand. Mm-hmm. Me and my childhood friends were singing those songs.
Mm-hmm. We did in high school, too.
Yeah.
And then I was in chorus. I mean, I played piano. I danced for 20 years. So I studied the most, I think I would say I studied with dance. But even with that, I wanted to be more expressive and funny. And I did more of that in college. And I studied piano for about 9 years. And then I was in chorus, and I was in the select choir and in high school. And so we toured around the Hartford area. I always like joke. I'm like, you know, we had quite the circuit. It was like nursing homes and school assemblies. So I got used to life on the road, you know, and, it was fun. So I was, and then,
it's pretty impressive though. I mean, you know, plenty of us do high school plays, but we're not touring. Yeah.
I mean, I'm joking that it was hardly touring, because it was just like after school you got to be at, you know, Mapleview Manor for this, you know, little concert you're gonna do.
Well, that's awesome. I was 30 before I knew you could go to nursing homes and perform, right? So mom was on top of it. She was like, listen, I got all the performance spaces mapped out, we're going. I like that.
Yeah, so that was fun. I mean, it was a pretty big part of my life growing up. And then even though like I desperately wanted the lead in the High School Musical, I never got it, and I always thought, oh, it's because it goes to the soprano and I'm an alto. And then I did something my high school when I was a senior. I thought for sure I was going to get it because they were doing Calamity Jane, which is it's like the first story I ever told on stage as a storyteller. It's such a ridiculous but very fun story. And I was like, I just want to be Calamity Jane. Cause I thought they need an alto and somebody who could dance and play a renegade. And I was like, oh my God, I got this on lock. I'm totally going to get it. And like our choral director, I call him Mr. Schmidt. It's not his real name, but, he was super intense, and like he put the fear of God in all of us. And he would, he had this like sort of blonde clown hair and his, like this, he wore shirts that were two sizes too small for him. Like he just didn't really do a good job enforcing. Well, he scared the crap out of us, but like his look didn't really match his intentions. And anyway, so he scared us all, but I didn't end up getting the lead. I wound up being relegated to the chorus, and they gave the lead to a junior. And yeah, I was like, this is bullshit.
Right? What's sucks. The point like, of growing up? Right?
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. Well, that's a
and
rough
she,
one.
And she totally sucked. So that made me even angrier. And like, she was known for soccer. I'm like, come on, I have dreams of being on Broadway. You most certainly don't, you know? And so Mr. Schmidt felt bad. So he gave me one line. Yeah. So in addition to just being in the chorus, which was fine, because it was like all my friends were in chorus anyway, so that's fun. But like, I was like, no, I dream big, you know? And
yeah, you do. You dream big. Now tell me, did this junior, is she currently working in theater and comedy?
No. Well, you can't even find her on social media.
Exactly. There we go. Mm-hmm. That's right.
But I got
Mr.
mine
Schmidt.
Because so you're in this one line and it's told from backstage, which is already insulting. And yeah, and it's the cue for the big opening number for the whole thing. And all I had to say was, it's the Deadwood stage, like this stagecoach is coming to town sort of thing. And then all the villagers come out and everybody's frolicking and happy and everything's great in Deadwood. But this is my cue for Mr. Schmidt, who's now in the pit, you know, directing the orchestra. And for whatever reason, Amy, I truly don't know why I did this, but I decided to take some liberties with that line. Yeah, I was like, I'm backstage. What's he going to do? And he put the fear of God in everybody. He really did. He was so scary. But I was just like, I was a clown, you know? And I like sort of gotten a little bit more comfortable like being silly outside of my house, you know? So my friends knew, like my friends all called my jokes Robin jokes because they're very punny and dorky. So I just was like, woohoo, yippee-ki-yay, ride 'em cowboy, it's the Deadwood stage, you know? And so like everybody came out, they're looking at me. We're all supposed to be singing, you know? And everybody's looking at me. And I'm like, I don't know. You know, like, I just thought it was fun.
It was fun. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they were like, what are you going to do tomorrow? Like, after the show, I was like, oh, I don't know.
Like, probably not that, because he's going to yell at me.
Well, he also, like, I mean, you've done plays, right?
Yeah.
Like, you get notes as soon as the show's over. I mean, after people say hello and stuff, you know, but, like, audience. He didn't do that. He would give you notes, like, right before the next show. Which is like gives you no time to work on anything. Not that I had much to work on, but like,
yeah,
he just had this very unconventional way of doing things. So so afterwards my friends were like, you know, what are you going to do? I was like, I don't know. I mean, I didn't plan any of that. And then I was like, oh, well, you know, I got such a warm reception. I don't want to let my fans down. And it was so stupid. I was like, I can kind of get away with this because there's no mention in the program of Village Idiot played by Robin Gelfenbein. So, yeah. So then the next night I go in, but I'm like, he's going to yell at me. He's totally going to yell at me when he gives notes. And he doesn't. And I was like, oh, sweet. All right. So now I went from like being furious at the junior. And she, by the way, is like plowing her way through the show and she sucks. Now I'm backstage and I'm like, give me my cue, bitch. Give me my cue because I got something good. And like I went even crazier the second night. And I honestly don't even remember what I said, but it was just like, what? Like it was just like, Jessup, bring me my spectacles and some lemonade. Who I am thirsty. Like it was just ridiculous. Like,
could they even hear you? I mean, like, were you mic'd?
No,
you're
no,
just I had yelling to really from the backstage.
I had to really project. Well, Mr. Schmidt certainly could hear me because, you know, he's right there in the pit.
Sure.
Meanwhile, like, he could have done it Oscar style and just played me, you know, played me, not played me off, but played, just, like, drowned me out, you know?
Yeah.
And he never did because I think he was like, wait, what is happening? This woman's taking over my show.
Yeah, maybe he was like, this is a problem I don't need to fix.
Yeah, I don't know.
He was like, right. It's fine.
Because I mean, I was like such a good kid all the time. And then it's like closing night and everybody's in the chorus room. We're all sitting there and he used to get so angry at us that like if people, we would do fundraisers for like our choral trips and people, we would do like rake leaves, you know, and stuff. And if people didn't show up because you'd have to fill out a form and then he'd scream at us and be like, sign up, show up, and like slam his hand down on the piano and like that sound would like echo through the chorus room. So when it's closing night, he's just like giving notes to the leads and some of the supporting characters and his blood is boiling, like his face is getting like beet red and he's getting madder and madder. And then he slams his hand down on the piano and he looks at me dead in the eye and he goes, no improvising, stick to the script. And I was like, oh shit, now I'm in trouble. And like I did everything to always avoid being in trouble. And everybody knew it was me because he's staring right at me. And also, like, hello. It was obvious. So I was like, all right, fine. I had my fun. And then show starts, and then we're all backstage. And I'm watching Maureen again. That's her name. I'm like, she's, like, fucking her way through the show. And I was like, this part should have been mine. Nobody ever saw my real potential. This is bullshit. And so it was like, I always say, I'm like, I unleashed, like, I channeled my inner Delta Burke. And I was like, wah! Like, it's just, like so over the top. Like, and I talked about, like, wow, Bill Hickok, get out here. I don't care if you have smallpox, this is huge. And then I milked it for the rest of the thing. I was like, it's the dead. By the way, I'm being quiet for the benefit of your listeners. What? Stage. Like, it's just so ridiculous. And like, everybody comes out, and like the whole chorus comes out. Nobody can sing. The band is like, pfft, like they can't even play because everybody's laughing so hard. And Mr. Schmidt is like officially blown a gasket. Like his tie is all askew and his hair is all fucked up. And he is like trying to conduct like fast and vigorously and like staring at me. And I was like, oh shit, he is pissed. And then I'm like, I didn't say this, but in my head, I'm like, you messed with the wrong girl, bucko. Like, don't mess around. But then, I mean, this is so pathetic because it was like the highlight of my high school career. And just to give you a sense of like, you know, how I really took a lot of chances then.
And you know what, though?
Like, I was like so proud of myself because I was like, you know, technically I didn't get the lead, but like, hey, I'm the one who stole the show because I played my own version of Calamity Jane.
Yeah. Right. Plus, yeah, like rebellion in high school is so necessary. Right. Like, honestly, even though, like, I'm sure he was mad in the moment, like, later on, you know, I'm sure it's like, well, she's better off because she's going to go her own way and be strong and make a decision and do it versus, like, somebody who's like, what am I supposed to do? It's like, those people are having a hard time in life, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you can be strong and mess with stuff, and also you're, like, confident enough to break a rule where it's like it was a very low stakes situation in that, like, sure, everyone's just going to have a fun time. The only one mad is the teacher, right? Yep. The audience liked it. Everyone in the show liked it. You know, you got a sweet story to tell out of it. Like, nothing wrong with that, right? Yeah. Like, all good. Sounds good.
I won the moth with that story, so I was pretty happy about that.
Take that, Mr. Schmidt.
That's right. I think the theme was jealousy, and I was like, oh, do I? Oh, I've got a good one for you. It's a fun one to tell because it's so, you can picture like a high school kid doing that, you know?
Yeah. So were you immediately
Waiting for Guffman didn't have something like that in their show, you know? I mean, in the movie. I love that movie.
Yeah. That one's very real. That was like the first like behind the curtain sort of like where they were like, this is a fun parody. And you're like, what do you mean? This is actually real.
Totally. Yeah. So many people are like, Best in Show is the best one. I was like, I can see why you think that. But if you did any level of community theater growing up, you know how completely realistic Waiting for Guffman is. Like, it's funny, but it's funny because it's true.
Yeah, well, you know what, though? Good on them for being like, okay, we did a great job with this movie, but it's not a huge hit. What do we add to make it better? And they're like, what about dogs? And you're like, oh, yeah, everybody loves dogs. And it worked. Yeah, it worked. It was like the exact same cast, similar vibe, mm-hmm. plus dogs. That's the key, guys. Add some dogs. Not to your live shows, but.
I just saw Mascots. Did you see that one?
No, I haven't seen that one. Is it good?
It was better than I thought. It's not as good as the other two that mm-hmm. we just mentioned, mm-hmm. but it's still, I was like, oh, this is surprisingly good. I mean, they added, there were a lot of people who weren't, like Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara are not in it.
Sure. They're busy.
Probably.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah, totally. And some of the newer comedian actors got to be in that too. That mm-hmm. must be, oh gosh, that must be what so fun when you get that call and it's like, what? Christopher Guest wants to hang out with me? Okay.
Yeah, totally. And getting to play with like Fred Willard, it's like, come on.
I know. Total comedy royalty for sure.
Mm-hmm. Indeedly do.
So what happened after high school? Were you immediately like, let's go get a theater degree at a college? Did you go to college? What was the path for you? How did you get from, I'm going to do some plays in high school to now living, and it's a big question and many years in between, but like, how do you get from I'm in high school plays to now you're working full time doing performances and stuff? What education mm-hmm. did you have? What'd you do?
So... I went to Syracuse and I wanted to study broadcast journalism because I thought I could be on TV and be funny. Like, but I wanted to do like features, like interviewing celebrities at the mall, or, you know, I'm like, I'll be the wacky weather girl, because I thought that that was like a safer sort of path, you know?
Totally. Yeah, wacky because... weather girl. Boats, 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 boats.
Yeah, because I was like, it wasn't really encouraged to go down this path.
Yeah.
So I was like, sure. Oh, but this can be acceptable, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So then I wound up, I wanted to study at their communications program, which is a really strong program, and I didn't get in right away. I got into the business school because my math scores were way better than my verbal SAT scores. And obviously for communications, you need better verbal scores. So I got into the business school, and then I transferred into the Newhouse School the earliest I could, which was like halfway through my sophomore year. And then I had to take like tests and get a certain, you know, like certain requirements, like credit requirements. And then I wound up not, I didn't actually, it's such a long story. I don't want to get into too much of the detail, but I had some like really crappy experiences happen where I was being like horribly bullied by about 60 guys. And so around the clock. So that like really kind of diminished my self-esteem, because I thought, oh, I don't want them to see me on the campus TV station because they'll make fun of me more. So I kind of laid low. I was doing things still, but not as actively as I really wanted to. I was very, very scared. But I still wanted to get my degree. And then I wound up having this amazing professor who had had like every job in a TV station. I also was working for like campus radio, but doing more on like the production side of things on like a Sunday morning show. But the professor wound up becoming my advisor, and he said, you're such a good writer. You should really be studying writing for television, radio, and film. And I'm like, really? Like, I don't think I'm a good writer. That's also because my self-esteem was like in the toilet. So
sure.
He was just like, you're so creative. And I didn't think I was creative at all. So I wound up studying that, and I had some amazing professors, and I still was taking some like broadcast journalism classes. And it's funny because I remember sitting there like towards the end of my senior year reading some copy, and the professor, like, I just started doing stuff in different voices, and like the class was howling, and the professor was like, I didn't know you were funny. And I'm like, yeah, I am. And because I never, like, because of what happened in college, I just was like such a mess. And so I finally was like finding that voice again, and I'm like, oh, people are laughing and people are responding to this, that's cool. And then I wound up getting what I consider the world's best job, which allowed me to be on TV and on the radio and be a ham and like be on camera mostly, and that was to be a driver of the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile.
Oh yeah.
So I had a very like unusual path, but there I was like totally free to express myself and my creativity. You know, they like paid me to say hot dog puns. So I was like, sweet,
yeah, right?
I can do that.
How'd you get that kind of job? Because I think of those jobs like promotional things, like when you see the people selling Red Bull around, they drive the Red Bull truck, or like there's a couple where it's like they really sell a lot of sometimes beer, like they'll send people out to go to places and be like brand ambassadors for that kind mm-hmm. of thing. How did mm-hmm. you even get connected with that kind of job? Was it like the professor was like, my friend runs the Wienermobile if you want to work?
No.
There.
Oh my God. It's like, it was a really hard job to get.
Oh really? Wow, good for you.
Oh
then.
Yeah. Rock well on. Thank you. I mean, I don't say that to like, you know, boastfully, but I mean, I am proud that
I
got it.
For sure.
I totally had to wow them with my creativity to get it, because they were the first company to ever do any kind of mobile marketing program. They started it in 1936, and nobody else was doing it when I applied, because this was like in the early 90s and early to mid 90s when I applied. So they had an information session at Syracuse, and I went and I was like, what in the world? Like, I have to do this. I'm so excited. And I wound up finding out that they were choosing 10 people out of 1,000 applicants. And the reason why it's so hard is because it's not just like smiling, handing out. They have these collector's items that are called wiener whistles. Mm-hmm. It's not just like handing out like coupons and wiener whistles and being nice to the public. We actually pitched media and came up with events to garner media attention and like just community goodwill everywhere we went. So they wanted to have people who had communications backgrounds, and they needed people to like represent the brand really well, because the web really wasn't around at that point. So we were their foot soldiers, and you had to be a good spokesperson for Oscar Mayer. And because we were, and we had like media goals we had to meet every quarter. So there was like a real bigger job behind the scenes that we had to do. And that's part of the reason why it's so hard to get is because, I mean, I had no media training or PR training going to Syracuse, but they gave it to us at Hot Dog High, but they needed to know like that you had like the potential and the skills to kind of work on that part of that was a huge part of the job, So, what I wound up doing was, you know, I like catered my resume to the job. I said, like, I got like a BSS degree in bologna sandwich skills and like bragged about my excellent driving record. And then like my cover letter had all kinds of puns in it. And then I was like, that's not going to be enough because that seems so obvious. People are going to do that. So then I was like, I made a cassette of me singing self-promotional songs.
Yes.
Yeah. And I called it Rockin' Robin's Hot Dog Holiday Favorites because it was around Thanksgiving leading into the holiday season. And I did like parodies of Winter Wonderland, and it was like, Oscar Mayer, do you hear me? Wanna be in that weenie? Like ridiculous. Like it went on from there. And then I made like a Christmas tree on the cassette with little hot dog ornaments and a menorah with little hot dog candles, which is obviously completely sacrilege. And then I sent off this packet. I'm like waiting and waiting and waiting, because like back then I'm waiting for a letter,
right?
You know, not an email.
Yeah, that's how I got into college, with a letter.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, wow.
So I get to, again, the first round. And I meet with somebody, a local like district manager, and we have a great conversation. It's like easy and fun. And I get to the second round, and at that point they've narrowed the pool down to 40 people. So they were sending people out in waves of 10. So they flew us in the night before for a hot dog social to like see if we to see like how we interacted with the senior execs and to see if we actually ate hot dogs. Cause apparently like a vegetarian had slipped through the cracks the year before. Yeah. Then amazing. You know, eventually they were okay with it, but I think for a future we were called Hot Doggers, and that's where I met this guy, Russ. And Russ was the spokesperson for, sorry, he was not the spokesperson. He was the Wienermobile manager.
Nice.
AKA Top Dog. And he was like Mr. Schmidt, like super intense. Like mm-hmm. This guy was a former Army sergeant. So I was like, Jesus Christ. And I had heard he was incredibly intimidating. So next morning, up at 7 a.m. at Hot Dog HQ in this conference room, it's like a reality show. There's like 10 people sitting around this conference room. We're all like, it's like these like super intense people, but like very energetic. It's kind of like Disney employees, but people who are also like really, you know, they were kind of cutthroat. Like one guy had made like a miniature version of the Wienermobile, and I was like, Jesus Christ. Like another guy for his on-camera interview was doing a debate between Ross Perot and Bill Clinton as to like which hot dog condiment is the best. So I was like, Jesus. And so, but I knew, I was like, I got something good. So I like meeting with like HR and PR and you know, sales and marketing, all these people throughout the day. And I'm feeling so good, Amy. I'm like, yeah, I'm nailing these interviews, doing really great. This is awesome. And then I go to my on-camera interview and I was like, I've got a showstopper for you guys. And I get to this windowless conference room and I look down and I'm like, oh, shit, how the hell am I going to tap dance on carpet? So I was like, I can't believe this is like the one thing I didn't think about. Meanwhile, I had been like practicing in the bathroom with my tap shoes quietly, because I had like a song and dance, and I had written another parody and I did a dance. So I wound up doing this like redonkulous like parody to the tune of the Bare Necessities. And the guy who's like shooting the video was just like so not. I was like, can you pan down on my shoes so they can see I've gone the extra mile? And he's just like, all right. And then he's like, whenever you're ready, you know, and I like launch into this routine. I finish and I'm like, wah, you know, and he's just like, they'll do it. Like, there's like no response. And I'm just so defeated. And I was like, okay, now I have to really like redeem myself. So I went over, I was like on my way to Russ's office and I'm so scared because I'm like, this guy is so, you know, intimidating. And I go in, we're sitting like a foot away from each other in his office. He asked me a bunch of questions. And then I ask him, like, did you have a chance to listen to my Wienermobile demo? That's exactly what I called my cassette, which is so, so ridiculous. And he's like, then he opens his top desk drawer and Rockin' Robin's Hot Dog Holiday Favorites is sitting there. I was like, oh my God, he knows my work. Oh my God. Like, I'm so excited. And he goes, oh, you're this Robin? I'm like, oh, I'm like, well, if you want, and he's like, no, I haven't listened to it. I was like, oh, well, if you want, you can listen to it on my Walkman right now. And he goes, that won't be necessary. And I was like, how about this? Why don't I sing a few songs that didn't make it on the album? The B-sides. And then I just launch into the two songs. And like the first one I sing, there's no response. It's meant to be funny, by the way. Nothing. And then I'm like, oh my God, this is my last chance. I have to go for it. And I sing the second one. The last thing I sing is, I'm going to have this job before I'm dead. And he goes, I was like, I don't really know what it means. But I just assume the worst. And I like cry the whole flight home. And I get back to campus. And I'm like, I made such an ass of myself. Everybody hates me there. And I'm just like, I wasted all of these 4 years, like being afraid of these bullies. And my life is worthless. Like, I really was just like in such a bad place. And then like a month later, I got a phone call and he's like, Robin. And by the way, he used to breathe like Darth Vader, which is also scary. So I was like, I'm like, Jesus. Yeah. And so I like screamed and I cried and I was so happy. I was like, oh my God. It was like, he had proposed to me. I was just like over the top. So happy. Cause it really, I say this all the time and I don't mean it in I mean it 100% seriously. That job totally saved my life. It's such a long story.
But then it led to you doing a one-woman show about it. How did that happen? So it's like, to jump forward, after you had this wonderful experience, you got the job, you have this wonderful experience, and then how many years after you did it did you write the one-woman show and start performing it?
I started performing that in 2007. So I started working on it in 2007. It premiered at the New York International Fringe Festival in 2008. So there's a huge gap in between there because I wrapped up the job in 94. And from there, like, I moved to Atlanta. I did improv in Atlanta. I lived in San Francisco. I did improv out there with Bay Area. Is it Bay Area Theater Sports? Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And then I moved to New York and I did like comedy intensive where I was like writing spec scripts and I did stand up and did all kinds of improv and all that stuff. And then I started out doing mostly stand up. This is like 2000. I started stand up and I didn't like it, but the first time I went up, the host was like, I told him it was my first time after I was done. I didn't want him to know ahead of time. And he's like, that was great. I was like, really? He's like, you're so natural. I was like, oh, thanks. That's nice to hear. But because it was mostly like set up punchline, you know?
Well, you had so much experience performing at that point. I mean, you had gone to 3 different cities to do different kinds of improv and performance. Yeah. Like, that's a lot, right? And you had a lot of experiences with different kinds of audiences. The audiences in Atlanta versus San Francisco versus New York are all very different. So the experience, plus like the Wienermobile experience of just traveling around and talking to your random, like a person who's going to a comedy club, they're like loosey-goosey. They're like ready to have a good time. But like schmo on the street when you swing up with a Wienermobile, that's way harder. So like, you had such intense experience. The hardest part about stand-up is getting through the part of, like, I need to speak now. And then, you know, Also, your professor clearly pointed out the truth of the matter, which is that you are a hilarious writer and that you this creativity that, like, can come out if you, like, organize it in this way. Like, the idea of the parodies that you wrote, so awesome. Mm-hmm. By the way, you telling me that you wrote those parodies, like, totally reinforces this thing. Like, I'm teaching this kids comedy camp, and next week I'm teaching them how to write parodies because I thought this is a good way to, like, get you into stuff. And now that you told me this story, I'm like, listen, guys, parody's got a girl a job. You could do this.
It's true. You never know what it can lead to.
You really don't.
Look at Randy Rainbow.
Right?
I mean, he's a machine with his parodies. I mean, you probably don't want to do that because that's all political, but...
No, but you can use parodies for whatever you want. Like, that's the beauty of a parody. A parody is you using a familiar thing to get information out, right? Now, sometimes, in the case of the Wienermobile job interview, you were trying to sell a product. Great, makes sense. Cool. They've done that before, and people like it. It's totally cool. But, like, with him using politics, that's just a different way. It's like a soft pitch of, like, here are some ideas, but you're going to enjoy it because it's the Brady Bunch theme or whatever. Like... You know, it's how comedy works. You know, you're like, you're like, look at my hand. It's swinging over here. By the way, here's some serious things to think about. Like, also right, what stand-up is, right? Yeah. So did you do stand-up more at this point because you were ready to move on to perform by yourself? You had had a lot of experiences with group performing, doing troops and whatnot. I have also had that, and I can understand being like, yeah, I'm done with navigating a bunch of other people. I want to do this, so how do I get it done? Was that what motivated you? You were like working with people, and then you were like, no, my path is my own. Or what made you want to go out by yourself? A lot of people find stand-up scary because you're alone, but you've done that, and you've done storytelling, and now you're hosting by yourself and doing things where, like, you're the main one we're all looking at. How did you get to the point of having the confidence to do that?
Well, with stand-up, because it was never anything I wanted. It was just part of the curriculum that I was doing with that intensive comedy program. And so I did it for like a year as part of this program. But then I explored...
What was the program?
It was through the American Comedy Institute. I don't even know if they exist anymore.
Oh, okay. Right on.
But it was like it was like a 7-month program, and I thought, okay, well, that's enough for me to do. And by the way, I had auditioned for the Groundlings too, but I didn't like LA, and I'd gotten in, but I didn't like LA, so I was just like, oh, what do I do? And I just was like, okay, I'll go there for 7 months, and then I'll come back because the company I was working for allowed me to work remotely, which was amazing. It was part of the reason I did it, and then I wound up. When it was over, I decided to stay, and I'm so glad. I'm glad I did, although it was like, it's the timing was like crazy because I had some stuff in storage. I flew back on the morning of September 11th, 2001, which is like intense and crazy. And I was like, oh my God, did I do the right thing? And the city's falling apart and the world's, you know, gone to shit. And a month later, I booked my first commercial, and it was, directed by Spike Lee. I was like, holy shit. And so I didn't answer your question. I'm sorry. But, just to share, like,
no, that's what a path.
Yeah. I was like, oh my God, I guess I should stay here. You know, it totally confirmed my decision to move there. Cause I was very nervous about it. Cause I never really loved New York. But from then on, I actually started writing original. I will say this too, just cause I think it's important for, anyone listening, but also for your students, that I had tremendous fear because of what happened to me in college of performing. I was terrified that people were going to be laughing at me and not with me. So I would be doing things that were protected, where I felt protected. And that means like in classes. So I would do like class performances, but then I was like, this isn't like, you're not being that brave. You're just in this cocoon. And I took classes at UCB and went through like that whole program. And I took classes like with, I mean, the instructor, one of my instructors was, Jason Mantzoukas, and one of my instructors was Matt Walsh, like at one point. But I was taking classes with, meaning like they were my fellow students with Mindy Kaling and Ben Schwartz. So like it's crazy to see how like it's amazing how well they've done. But like I was part of like that UCB crew like early on. That was like really kind of when they were really establishing themselves. So, but anyway, the point is like I wanted to do so much with it, but I was so incredibly terrified of like the traumatic thing that had happened in college. So every year on New Year's Day, I would write commit to comedy. And I just had such a hard time with it. And eventually I took a solo show class at the Pit. That was in 2004. And I met somebody there and I started writing original comedy songs. And then I started playing the piano with it and singing these original comedy songs. I had a CD at one point, but she and I paired. We got like a 1 hour slot at the Pit. I did 30 minutes. She did 30 minutes. She did a character. And from there, we decided to start a sketch troupe together. And we co-produced that. And we had four other guys in the group. And we toured with that for a couple years. And then that was when I was like, I don't like playing characters. I just want to be myself. I want to do my Wienermobile show because I knew there was something really powerful with that story. So then I took a solo show class in 2007. And I was still doing some of my original comedy songs. But then that really pushed me to share that story, which nobody was talking about bullying even then, and it was scary. The bigger part of the Wienermobile story is like once I actually get in the vehicle, but sharing like the sort of pun intended meat of that story is important. So it's not just all like waka waka waka, you know. So yeah, so then I did the solo show, and then in 2009 I finally started storytelling. I had a friend tell me many years earlier, you should totally do this. You'd be so good at it. You should check out The Moth. And I'm like, uh-huh. And then I finally did. And I was like, oh, I see why you told me I should have done this years ago. But right. So I've touched a lot of different elements of the comedy world. But it's storytelling so has been where I've landed, and I absolutely love it.
Totally. It's so hard to take people's advice, though. And it sucks when later on you get in there and you're like, man, I really should have listened to them. But we all have to get there on our own way. You know?
I agree. And I think like when you learn these other disciplines, it's so helpful because with improv, like exploring and heightening, like those rules are really important for anything, for sketch, for storytelling. There's so much overlap. Plus, I felt like I also worked in advertising, so like my writing got better for everything that I did because everything has to be super tight, you know? And
oh yeah, so advertising is that, so like after, I could totally see that the stuff that you got that you had to do for being in the Wienermobile was like such like marketing and content creation and all the stuff that's like important these days. Like, so during the, when you weren't on stage doing comedy, your day job was in advertising? Because that seems perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
Ugh, great.
So I, I mean, first, like when I was in Atlanta, I was working for a sports agent / sports marketing firm. So I learned a lot there. And then I was a recruiter. When I was in San Francisco and New York, I was a recruiter for creative positions. Because I am such a people person and I like connecting people. But then I was like, I want to do some of these jobs. But totally. After that, then I actually lost that job. I was laid off in 2001. And then I started becoming a freelance copywriter / creative director. Well, no, I wasn't a creative director for a while, but the first gig I got was at Food Network when they were not as branded as they are now. They were open to a lot of cool stuff. And the guy who was the executive producer of creative services, he brought me in because I did stand up. He didn't look at the rest of my portfolio. Hmm. He just liked that I did stand up. Yeah, because I was writing, and then he hired me to write comedic spots for Andy Richter. I was like, yeah.
Nice.
I'll totally do that. Yeah, they did this thing called the Couch Potato Marathon. It was super fun.
Awesome.
Super fun. It's like, oh, I know this guy.
Yeah.
And I got 30 seconds. Got to write, and it's basically writing sketches.
Plus, promise, tell me that Andy Richter is nice.
They never produced it.
What? You never met him? Like, you wrote all this stuff, but he never got to say what you...
Happens a lot, where you, like, write scripts and scripts and scripts, and then they never produce them.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's a hard part. I was just thinking, like, you're in a room, and he's sitting on a couch, and they're like, okay, next movie is this. What do we say, Robin? What do we say? And you just toss him lines, and he says stuff. Oh, man. Yeah, I bet you. Yeah, I bet you wrote so much that didn't happen.
I got to work with other cool people, but I did not get that chance, unfortunately. I know.
It's all good.
I know. God. Like, especially then, because he was so popular.
Oh, he's my new favorite, like, podcast host, too. Like, his new podcast is, like, my favorite. So,
what's it called? I've heard about it.
Three Questions with Andy Richter. He's just so warm and sweet and self-effacing. And it's like, I love it. I love it more than the ones that I've been listening to for years. Like, I stopped and I just listen to him all the time. It's just, he's lovely.
Is it short?
No. I mean, it's an hour. But again, people say with podcasting that you do what you like. So, like, people have often said to me, like, oh, why are you having these long conversations? But I love having the long conversations because I love listening to the long conversations. And also, like, from the point of view of, like, me being a human and you being a human, I think it's more fun when we talk for a little while, right? That's like, if we talk for 10 minutes, then it's like, well, you got, like, kind of a vague notion. But, like, now it's like we get to dig in and figure it out and even talk about, like, even the idea of what we're talking about right now, which is, like, you wrote this thing for Andy Richter and then it didn't happen. Like, that's such a real thing that happens in comedy work. Like,
all the time.
Yeah. Like, you can't, like, hate yourself, right, about it. You are working, you're doing it. Like, don't hate yourself for it not being made. You know,
I absolutely don't. But because it was my first thing, I was like, this is an amazing, you know, like, entrance into this world.
Totally. Totally. So no, I'm just thinking, for people listening, like, this is, if you're going to be a writer, that's like a real thing that happens where, like, you know, you put stuff out there or, like, you write something, they buy it, and then it goes on a shelf forever and no one ever sees it. Or, like, you work on a whole project and then, like, right at the end, they're like, oh, by the way, we couldn't get the rights to do it, so we're not doing it. And you're like, what?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, I mean, it's just such a real, like, if you're working in this kind of stuff, like, it's very likely you're going to do a lot of work and nobody might ever see it. But I suppose if you've been working in live theater for a long time, you can accept that.
That's true. But the other thing that I would say that I think has really been, like, incredibly invaluable to me in terms of rejection is working in advertising, because my work has been rejected so many times. And I'm not saying it because I am not good at what I do, but it's just the reality. And it's a different kind of business than theater or comedy where people are rejecting your work. So it helped me develop really thick skin when I started sharing other work of mine, because I just was like, okay, it's not so much about me. It's about, you know, the audience, it's about the client. That is so true for auditions. Like, I don't even get nervous for, like, commercial auditions, because I've been on the other side of that table. And I'm just like, whatever. Like, I know this has, like, a client. Like, I've worked on so many brands where they are so nitpicky about the littlest things you wouldn't even imagine. You wouldn't even imagine. I worked on a website for this very well-known brand who I won't mention. Mm-mm. And during a call, they were like, I'm not so sure about the gray in the footer. Kind of reminds me of Battleship gray, and that kind of makes me think of Nazis. And I was like, okay. So this was, I think it was like 6 years ago. I was like, okay, I'm going to assume, because I'd met all these people, I was like, I'm pretty sure I'm the only Jewish person on this call. So I'm just going to let you know, like, that actually never was like a consideration when I was looking at the website. That didn't cross my mind. So I don't know if that should be something that need the consumers to be concerned about, you know, that should be a fear for the consumers. Like, I hung up the call and I called my partner. That's what you call in advertising. You've got, like, art directors, copywriting partners, creative team. And we are both creative directors. And I was like, what the hell was that? I'm like, are you kidding me? That's what they're concerned about? I was like, and then we got in this whole conversation after that of, like, warm white versus cool whites. I was just like, so that we wouldn't use the word gray anymore. I was just like, oh my lord. Like, what in the ever living fuck?
There is something so,
just so for,
funny
like,
about
your
that.
Your students who maybe are doing any kind of like working with commercials too.
Yeah.
Like, you just need to know, like, if you don't book stuff, it's very often has nothing to do with you.
Yeah. Also, it also like doesn't really have anything to do with you when it comes to like what they're looking at. Like even though you are what they're looking at, it's not you personally. Like, I was in this commercial where I was a roller derby girl, and I know you're not visually looking at me, but I'm a large plus size woman, right? And I am, they strapped me into so many Spanx and they got me into some tight Lycra, and then they put roller skates on me and they stand me in front of 5 ad execs who talk about me like I'm a picture. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was such a fascinating experience. Thank God I am like sociology first, ego second, because I was like, what an experience it is to be a picture. Like, because they were like, I don't know about this little piece of yellow here. Could we pull it down? And then like a costume girl would mess with me. I was just like, God, this is so funny. Like, if I had been at all worried about them saying like, she's fat, but they hired me, so who cares? I was hey, man. I'm it. We're recording this right now. Like, this is happening. But it was just such a funny thing to be like a statue for them. And they would come over and like, they'd ask the costume, oh, can we fix this piece of hair? Okay, what about this thing? And I was just like, oh God, it's so
much about
funny.
Perfectionism.
Yeah. And it's like in 30 seconds when you put me into the roller rink, like this wrinkle is coming back and my hair is flying out. Like, I'm going to be moving in the air. Like, so funny, though. Like, just the details. Like, this gray isn't gray enough, or your hair looks a little flippy. It's like, oh, so funny. Is that really going to sell this for you?
Totally.
Man.
Yeah, and it's funny because, like, because you just never, like, I was in a commercial a few years ago where I played a dentist, which I found hilarious because I was like, I have worked on so many brands that are connected to oral care, like Philips Sonicare and like Colgate, and like I worked on tons of projects for Colgate, and I was like, well, I know something about dentistry, like I know nothing about dentistry, but I was, all I had to do was yawn, and I was like, because I was playing a dentist who was tired, and the patient was nervous, because it was for a sleep aid pill, I can't remember what it's called, and I was like, well, so I went in, and I'm like, like, that's all I did. And it was hysterical. I'm like, I got the callback? Really? Okay. And I went in and I got paired with this guy who I found out later is like a character on freaking Sesame Street, which is amazing. Yeah. And we did our thing. I yawned a million times, which is funny because then it actually makes you really tired the more you do it.
Yeah.
And when we left, he goes, you made some really good choices. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm like, I didn't think I made any choices. Like, what kind of choices can you make when you're yawning? You know? Seriously. Like, what? I was like, oh, thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it. He's like, because they were all laughing and they were laughing. I was like, they're mostly laughing at him because he had all these great facial expressions. And here I am, you know, clown was like, you know, I mean, it was just so, to me, it was just so funny. So when my agent like emailed me like, you booked it, I'm like, are you kidding me, seriously? And then she, I mean, I was thrilled, of course, and we wound up shooting it at the sound stage where they did two things that they're known for, the Single Ladies video, which was super cool. And so this guy Chris and I like reenacted that, you know, like with like the wave. Sure. And then and they used to shoot porn there. Yeah, great. Cool.
Hilarious. Oh man,
it was hilarious. And then like the next audition I went out for, it was like a bird caller for IHOP, and so I like contacted Stacy. I was like, that's my agent. I was like, so what are you just sending me out for stuff that like where I'm just making sounds now, I'm not actually speaking? I just yawn or I do bird crawling, or is yodeling on the dock, like what's happening? What's next?
Is this you? Is this your way of telling me you got a Ricola commercial?
Ricola. No.
I was like, yes, that's me, actually. Everyone, you know, Ricola. You're listening. It's just me. They dialed down the voice, so it sounded like a man, but it was really Robin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I didn't audition for that. I'm open to it if anyone from Ricola is listening, but.
I think they're doing a lot of marketing right now. I don't know. Maybe. We'll see.
I don't know. I hate to say it if people are coughing, you know.
Yeah, you need a Ricola. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Perfect advertising. Mm-hmm. Good job.
Thanks. But, you know, it also helped me, like, learn how to promote my own stuff.
Yeah.
Like, working in that business. Because I'm always like, what's in it for the audience? That's the biggest question I always ask myself with every project I work on. And it also, because when you're promoting, because so often people don't want to promote themselves or they feel weird. Some people have no problem with it. But I think most artists don't want to. And it's like, if you position it in a way where you make it about the audience and what they're going to get out of the experience, then it kind of takes some of that pressure off of you. And so with when I started Yum's the Word, which is my storytelling show, I started that almost 9 years ago. I was like, okay, I'm going to have funny true stories, because nobody really was doing that. There's plenty of storytelling shows in New York, but nobody was just only doing funny true stories. Although actually, now that I take that back, The Liar Show was doing that, which I loved. And I was going to make homemade ice cream cakes for it.
Yeah.
And I was like,
I saw that you make homemade ice cream cakes. How is that a skill that a person develops? And then B, how do you take an ice cream cake from your home in a New York City apartment and travel it to a location without it melting?
Excellent question. Thank you for the empathy. Because if you only knew. The skill, I have so many stories of that. The skill of I developed because my aunt used to make them when we were kids. And she actually made pretty simple ones compared to now what I've created. Because I'll put, like, and I would let the audience decide. So we would have people celebrating their birthdays of the show, and they would get to pick, like, the layers and the toppings and the flavors and all that kind of stuff. And it took me, I'm going to guess, a year before I found a cooler to transport my ice cream cakes to the venue. And I get carsick. So I used to take that cooler into the subway, up and downstairs. And by the way, depending on the show, I would do like 3 to 5 ice cream cakes. Which also begs the question, how do you have that space in your New York City apartment freezer? I put nothing else in there. And sometimes I like use my neighbor's apartment. If we have like a big show, like when we had Mo Rocca on the show in December, he was my dream guest. Oh, it was one of the best nights of my life, if not the best night of my life. It was amazing. I mean, I worked my ass off on that show. But he is a love. But anyway, I'd made 5 for that. 5 cakes for that. And there were times where, so the cooler, because so often, this is going to sound super dorky, and feel free to cut this because I don't know how
I'm into this cooler stuff. Let's talk about it.
What'd you say?
I said, I'm into the cooler stuff. Let's talk about it.
All right. So, like, your standard cooler is wide and not high, right?
Right.
And sometimes they have wheels and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they have like that wheelie thing to, like, you know, like a wheelie suitcase where you can pull it, and sometimes they don't. And I was like, I cannot store a wide ass cooler in my apartment. That's ridiculous. And also, I would bring pans. I was going to like Kmart, bringing my ice cream cake pans, trying to stack stuff to see how it would work. I was like, these things are all going to topple over onto each other. It needs to be stackable vertically. I was a maniac. I was trying to find, I couldn't find anything online. I don't know why. I would walk by like a bodega or like a newsstand and see their cooler. I'd be like, hey, where'd you get that? Like, and then I would be, sometimes I'd have a piece of paper with me and I'd be like, okay, that's 11 inches high. So I could like measure how, I mean, I was ridiculous. And at some point I was walking, like it was in winter. I was walking down the street in New York, and I saw my dream cooler, and I was like, where'd you get this? How much was it? Like a million questions. And can I take a picture of it? He's like, yeah. Like, okay, crazy lady. And it was like, I think it's a Coleman cooler. I'm actually not in New York at the moment. But it was, okay. It was exactly what I needed. I was like, this is perfect. It's rolly. It's got like good, like, it's like the tires on this thing are no joke. It's like going to off-road. It's amazing. And I could stack 4 cakes in there. And when I stack them, like, by the way, because I spend so much time putting these together, it takes 3 days to make just one ice cream cake. And by the way, I used to make all the ice cream too. And that was its own adventure. I don't do that anymore. But
God, you are so wild.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm crazy, some would say. They're like, it's hard enough to produce a show. I'm like, trust me, I know. And they're like, then you put on this whole other layer of ice cream cakes. I was like, oh, yeah. And I'm catering it to what these people want. I'm not just like
that's,
making up.
That's ridiculous. Well, I'd be like, I'm making these cakes. You're going to like it. Get over it.
Yeah, I mean, nobody. So at one point, my friend was like, you know, Robin, people don't just come for the ice cream cakes. Like, you don't have to do that. You can farm that out. And I was like, I love that it's customized. I think it's really important. Because some of the cakes I'll do, like, donuts as a layer. I mean, Baskin Robbins isn't going to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't go to Baskin Robbins. I would use a local New York brand. And I've met many of them. And they're wonderful people. Anyway, the whole thing is, yeah, I got a little... That's so crazy. Funny. And there was one time that was the most heartbreaking thing I'll just share very quickly. Also, like looking for a venue, by the way, is like the number one criteria is, do you have a freezer? I always had to know that. And it's hard to find in New York.
Yeah.
And I found one. That took a long time too. And they were like, well, we have a cold storage unit. I'm like, what's the temperature? Like, they said 40 degrees. I was like, all right, well, freezing is 32. We all know that. 8 degrees warmer. I don't know what that does to my ice cream cakes. So, like, science was a worst subject in school to the point where my sister used to go, she got a C in science. Boo-boo. She got a C in science. Du-du-du-du. I'm sure your students are like, what are you talking about, lady?
It's a sweet parody. I'm into it.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, it's going to be hard to find a venue with a freezer in it for sure.
Yeah. So now these things are like, I have like 8 condoms on each one of these things. I put them in a plastic bag and then I put them in one of those hot cold bags, and each one of those hot cold bags gets 2 ice packs. Like, I'm crazy because I'm just like, if this, all this work, and like if they melt, I will be absolutely heartbroken. And one night one of them did. And it was because the venue was like, oh, we have this other little freezer here if you want to put one of those in there. I'm like, I'll try it. Okay. So it was just one. But out of 3, that's a bummer. And we went back and it was soup. And I was like, oh.
You're like, who likes soup? 3 audience cool. members. And you're like,
how many
this is
straws
yours.
You have? Yeah.
You're like, by the way, this is not a freezer. I've taken up a lot of your day, and I know we both need to go.
I've given massive long stories to like my entire comedy career.
No, you're perfect. I just wanted to ask you sort of one last question. What is the thing that you're doing now, or either COVID times or previous, that is like the exciting project that you're working on now? I know that you're still doing Yum's the Word, and you're still making the ice cream cakes, and I am fascinated by all of that. Like, the ice cream cake part was my question, so I'm so glad we talked about it. Because it was like, okay, storytelling show, I got it. Uh-huh. You get guests, cool, I get it. Ice cream cakes, tell me everything. So I'm down. But like, what's the thing that you're working on now or thereabouts time-wise that's like exciting to you, most exciting to you?
My screenplay about driving the Wienermobile.
Ooh.
My writing partner, it's funny because my writing partner saw my solo show in 2011 and said, I want to write, this would be an amazing buddy movie. I'm like, I know. Because I get paired with my complete opposite in the Wienermobile, just to give you a sense. So it's like, you know, like he listens to hip hop, I listen to show tunes, like he was like a total horn dog. I was a virgin. Like, it's just like, you know, ripe for this. And she approached me and she wanted to get the rights to the story. And I said, I actually was always hoping I could write this with somebody rather than just turn it over to someone. And she was exclusive with another writer at the time. So we said, okay, well, thanks, but no thanks. And then several years later, I reached out to her again. I'm like, are you still like exclusive with that partner? She said, no. And so we started working on it, but you know, she's got a little one and things, you know, things make it hard to sort of write. But we
sure,
started
world pandemic. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, but even prior to that, just like, you know, we both have different things going on in our lives and trying to connect. And, you know, I've never worked with a writing partner before, except like when I did sketch comedy. It's different because that's so much shorter than writing a screenplay. It's like such a bigger animal. And so we started at the beginning of the pandemic, and then stuff happened with her kid and school and having a hard time with him, you know, on Zoom. And she was just like, I can't. I have to take a break from this for a bit. So I was doing a lot of writing with it. And we have a call later today about it, which is exciting. And we have a call with a, I took a class and I got like a free one-on-one consult with
nice.
One of their peeps. And that's next week. So I'm like pretty fired up for this. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I did some virtual shows for Yum's the Word. At the beginning we did about four of them, and you know, I'd already done, this is like another thing for your students, I hosted and created shows in virtual reality last year for Microsoft, which is like, what? That's a whole other thing, just something to explore. But that actually helped prepare me for this world, and I had a lot of experience with that. So but I'm putting that on pause because like people don't want to be in front of screens all day, you know.
Yeah, it's like we did all the screen time for a year in 3 months, and now it's like, that's why when people are like bemoaning the, they're like, oh, theater's over. I'm like, theater's not over. We are dying to be in the room with each other. We are literally hoping we could do anything like spending time in a room with one another. Theater is going to be huge when we're allowed to do it again, because everyone's like, can I sit really close to a stranger? He's going to cough on me and I feel safe. It's the best. Like, it's not, you know, that's what we want, you know, and all the figuring out how to make online stuff. I mean, that's wonderful. It has opened us up to learning from people all over the world and playing and meeting different people. And that's great. I mean, the internet literally, you know, admittedly, we were connected through a person I met in person, but here we are. We're strangers talking over the internet. And there's something beautiful about that because we can. Right? Mm-hmm. Because this is a technology that we live in the world of, and that's super great. But, you know, as soon as the time comes that we're able to get back on stage, you and I both are going to be doing it because A, it's what we love, and then B, people want to see it and want to be part of it and feel the energy of other people. So we're coming back for sure, for sure.
Yeah, just have to be patient with it. I'm excited for the energy of other people in a theater space. Way more so than on the subway.
Yeah, definitely, for sure.
Very different, you know, purposes.
Yeah. I
love
that
plenty of entertainment on the subway, so, you know,
yeah,
that you don't even pay for. That is thrust upon you.
I love that you mentioned that you took, that you take all these classes. You know, you're using this one-on-one that you got through a workshop that you took to help you write this screenplay. You're still taking classes all the time, even though you're working constantly in this art form, you're still trying to get better and better. And I think that is a great indication of what a good artist you are, because it's not like you're just like, well, this is me, check it out. You're like, how do I learn more? How do I develop? How do I take what's around me and let it inspire me? Even like this woman asked, hey, can we write on this? And it took a few years before your brain came together and was like, you know what, let's do it. Or like, you know, you finally take this class that allows you to have somebody to give you a one-on-one on the screen play. Like, that's just really cool and very admirable.
Thanks.
That you're like continuously making yourself better and better.
I try. Thanks. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's plenty of low days where I'm like, what am I doing? But it certainly helps from, you were talking about like doing stuff on your own versus working with people. I miss that accountability. You have to really be very driven to do a lot of the stuff, you know, yourself. And because I want to do more with hosting, because I absolutely love hosting, and you know, like I host a kid's show. I've been hosting a kid's show during the pandemic. Like, that's easy, you know, but having a writing partner helps you be more accountable. And then classes always do. Absolutely, classes do. You know, so I feel like that's so often why people take them, is just to, you know, get moving on a project so you have 10 built-in deadlines. Otherwise, it's really hard to motivate ourselves to commit, you know?
Absolutely. And then you have all these other people around you that can inspire you with this or that reaction. You know, either they're similar to you or they're like taking the inspiration and doing something different with it. And you're like, what is that guy's brain about? But It makes you work and it makes you figure it out and become more creative.
Totally. And I actually was really inspired because somebody who I'm friendly with, who had a huge role over at Broad City, was in my class, but he wasn't showing himself on screen. So I privately messaged him, and I'm like, "Is this the same person I think it is?" Because it could have been like it was a kind of a common-ish name, and he was like, "It is. Hey, Robin, how are you?" And I'm like, "That's super cool that he's polishing." You know, so it's like you can never, I've often like thought like maybe I should take classes again so that I'm not so structured with things and I can have a little bit of fun and learn to let go again. You know, I think that we can always benefit from classes and, because you just never, like you said, you never know what you're going to learn. And also, like, I don't know if you feel this way about teaching, like, because I teach storytelling too. Like, I learn a ton from my students.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I like to teach. I teach 101, Improv 101. I teach the same most basic elements of it every single time. But for me, it's different. For them, I hope I give a consistent education. I'm using the same syllabus from the schools that they give me. And I do that, and that's great. But for me, every time I learn something new from them, and then it informs me for the next group that I teach. You know, it's like, hey, the last class had this situation go on. I wonder if this class will have the same bump in the road or whatnot. Yeah, it's really great. It's really wonderful to be able to connect with people both as a student and as a teacher. I think that also for you, the landscape of New York improv is changing quite a bit. Perhaps that will actually lead to, I have high hopes that like it will mean that the other theaters in town who are able to stay open are able to thrive and actually have a creative renaissance, because all these other people will need a new home. And they'll find different spots all around, and then they will meet new people, and the collaborations will create new and exciting art forms. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing. It's crazy to say goodbye to something like UCB. It's not over forever, but it's certainly over in New York. But that doesn't mean that art is gone, or that even the UCB community is gone. They're all still there. They just need a stage to do stuff on, and as soon as it's available, they'll be finding a spot to put up their shows and song and dance numbers and everything. So, I mean, it should be really interesting to see how that susses out. And, you know, maybe, you know, your classes can help people, and then maybe there are some classes where somebody's like, hey, I have this knowledge I've never been able to share, and you're like, what? I want it. So, who knows?
Yeah, I think it's good practice to just take a little dip into each one of the art forms to see how one informs the other, or one kind of overlaps with the other, because this guy interviewed me for his podcast a few weeks ago, and he's an incredible storyteller. He's won the Moth like 45 times. It's insane. And I said something to him. And he wrote an amazing book called Story Worthy. And, you know, so obviously we're friends and we're peers. And I said something to him about the idea of truth in comedy. And he was like, I said, have you ever heard of that? And he's like, no. And I said, oh, that's like Improv 101. Well, besides like Yes And, of course. I said, there's a book called Truth in Comedy, which is like a must for all improvisers. It applies to everything, because you don't have to force jokes in a story. You just have to understand who that character is and figure out what those personality traits are, which most of the time is us. So we know ourselves, you know, pretty well. And then you can figure, you don't have to force, like, well, first of all, our stories are quite often so funny anyway. Like, you don't have to force that. And you just find the things that are funny as the story is unfolding. And that's where the humor comes in. And he's like, oh, I never knew that. I'm like, huh?
Interesting. So fascinating the way people come at creative information. You know, we all learn from different things. I didn't know improv was a thing until I was 30 years old. Like, are you kidding me?
Oh, really?
That's
Where'd
ridiculous.
You grow up? Did you grow up in Austin?
I grew up in Boston. I lived in New York for 10 years during UCB's height, and I didn't ever hear of it because I was doing random avant-garde open mics over on the Lower East Side with Michelle Carlo. I didn't know. I had
surf
enough
reality.
Surf Reality, Collective Unconscious, Bowery Poetry Club, that whole crowd. Mm-hmm. I was fulfilled with, you know, my creativity with them, so I wasn't like looking to take classes. And then later when I moved away and they were like, "You lived there and you didn't take classes?" I was like, "I didn't even know." What?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah,
crazy.
Those were very divided sort of audience, like groups, like not like in a bad way. It just was, you know, a different sort of spirit.
It's
to
a
each
big
one.
City too. Like you pick an area, you stay in that area. So, you know, it's all good. Mm-hmm. Robin, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to chat with me and share your stories with my audience.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. Great.
Thanks for having me, and best wishes with your kids' comedy camp.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.